We're going to hear now about two of the most controversial words in education these days, screen time. One fear about screen time is that it's hurting kids' social skills. On Morning Edition today, we heard about a recent experiment. Researchers found that kids who spent time away from electronic devices got better at reading emotions on people's faces. But for some educators, screen time isn't all bad. Corey Turner of the NPR Ed team has the story of one Los Angeles school that's embracing technology in an effort to protect kids from it.
Yay! Can you say good morning, Ms. Vogelson?
Good morning, Ms. Vogelson.
The hallways are humming with kids at Westside Neighborhood School. It's morning. A gaggle of first graders has wrapped up breakfast and heads to class. WNS is an independent school, pre-K through 8th, tucked into the shadow of a Home Depot in L.A.'s booming Playa Vista neighborhood. It's close enough to the ocean that the air is more salt than smog.
So our third grade is on this side, and here is the lab right here.
I get the grand two-story tour from Judith Joy. She's executive assistant to the head of school, and she walks me to the technology lab.
So you can see we have a room full of computers, and then on the side we have our nice little robots that the kids get to play with and tinker around with. And you should see the stuff they create. It is really awesome.
We'll come back to the lab in a minute, but first, the man behind Westside's pretty radical technology policy, head of school Brad Zacuto. When it comes to talking about screen time and kids' access to handheld devices, he likes to use an old-fashioned analogy.
It's like putting a child behind a wheel of a car. There's a lot of power there.
Zacuto says, think about how dangerous it was back when cars first hit the road. No traffic lights or street signs. Well, that's where we are now, he says, with kids and all this technology at their fingertips.
It's here to stay. But at some point, you have to teach kids how to drive a car responsibly.
How does he do that? First, no smartphones till sixth grade. Even then, kids can bring them to school, but they have to check them at the front desk. Second, by engaging and educating parents. WNS makes them sign a commitment to limit screen time at home and to keep kids off of social media, again, till sixth grade. Also, at school, no technology at all until second grade.
We choose to have our youngest children engaged in digging in dirt and building things and using their hands.
Not just hands, but eyeballs and brains, too, interacting with other kids face to face. Because they need lots of early practice relating, reading emotion, and responding to it. Screen time just gets in the way. In second grade, Zacuto says, kids start using classroom laptops. They get some basic lessons in typing and word processing, and their first taste of internet research, which makes this a good time to go back to that technology lab.
Hi, how's it going? Don Fitzroy, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, Don.
Don Fitzroy is EdTech coordinator at Westside Neighborhood School. By fourth grade, just about every student has sat through a class like this.
So we're going to be talking about digital citizenship today. And I wanted to begin by giving you guys an opportunity to watch a short video about something called a digital footprint.
The idea is to get kids to think hard about the dangers of social media before they have Twitter handles or Facebook pages. After the video, Fitzroy sits in a half circle with a handful of students and talks through a cautionary tale.
They say something online, and then suddenly they say, I'm going to delete this. I know I changed my mind. I didn't mean to say that. And it's out there.
13-year-old Tom Zimmerman gets it.
One example, this one kid who was like, in this room, and he had like this fake lightsaber, and he was acting really crazy, and it looked really stupid. And it was funny, but I'm sure that kid won't want it in the future. But so many people have taken that video and put it on their channels that there's no way of getting rid of it.
That video of one kid in a heated lightsaber battle with himself is pretty amazing. He's swinging a golf ball retriever, and he's just so intense about it, high stepping, swatting the floor, losing his balance. It's been watched millions of times. But the so-called Star Wars kid, now in his 20s, says he was bullied because of it and had to leave school, which gives principals like Brad Zacuto not one, but two big reasons to worry about screen time. Because of what's not happening, important face-to-face time, and because of what is happening, kids putting themselves out there in embarrassing and potentially dangerous ways, which raises the question, what is good screen time?
It's all about how things are used and how much they're used and what they're used for.
Patricia Greenfield co-authored that study we mentioned in the intro. She's a professor of psychology at UCLA and has been writing about screen time for 30 years. She says, for example, asking kids to write an essay using the computer can be a good thing. It can help with spelling and grammar, and they can use the internet for research. Here's the key.
You're not substituting screen time for interaction time. You're substituting alone time with the screen for alone time with your paper and pen.
Greenfield describes a kind of cost-benefit analysis. Is this screen time coming at the expense of face-to-face time? And what unique value does the technology add? At Westside Neighborhood School, when kids use tech, often they're still working collaboratively and doing things they couldn't do without it. Again, head of school, Brad Zacuto.
We have a design class where they imagine a product, they design it, and we have a 3D printer where they then create it. I mean, there's amazing things going on that's preparing them for the world they're going into.
Another simpler example, math homework. Kids in the same class but at different skill levels can do work that matches their ability. And starting in sixth grade, Zacuto students can do it all on school-issued tablets. Some teachers even put short lectures online for students to watch at home.
It sort of flips the content. I'd rather be spending my time in school with the teacher, with the kids, doing interactive collaborative, using what we've learned.
Which, oddly enough, means using screens to increase the time kids at WNS spend working face-to-face. It's a delicate dance, preparing kids for both the digital age and the social world. But it's important not to sacrifice one for the other, says Yelda Uhls, who co-authored that screen time study with Patricia Greenfield. When kids hit middle school, she says, the balance of power in their lives tilts away from their parents toward friends.
One of the reasons it's so miserable is because we're trying to learn our place in the social world outside of our safe little haven at home.
The more practice kids get, reading emotion in voices and posture, the better they'll be able to navigate the turmoil of early adolescence. And that kind of learning just won't fit in the palm of your hand. Corey Turner, NPR News, Washington.
The White House recently announced another step in its effort to end sexual assault on college campuses, a public service campaign called It's On Us. And when it comes to studying sexual violence, college surveys are important. But those surveys often don't include students at historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs. One major study found sexual assaults are lower on those campuses than others, but some question those numbers and whether HBCUs have the resolve to openly address the issue of campus rape. NPR's Cheryl Corley traveled to two schools and has this report in our ongoing series, but we should warn you, her report includes a young woman's description of an alleged sexual assault.
There are more than 100 historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, in the country. Morgan State University in Baltimore ranks in the top 15. During the school's fall matriculation convocation, professors dressed in their full cap and gown regalia strolled into the Fine Arts Building auditorium where hundreds of students were already waiting.
I'm very excited to speak to you this morning to mark the official beginning of the 2014-2015 academic year.
Morgan State President David Wilson proudly described the ongoing building boom at the sprawling campus and successful efforts to retain more students. But amidst the pomp and circumstance is the fact that Morgan State is the only HBCU on the list of more than 70 universities and colleges the Department of Education is investigating for how they handle cases of sexual assault. Over at the Student Center, 20-year-old Christopher Brown, a junior, found it difficult to believe his school was on the list.
I think that it's preposterous because sexual assault cases, I was unaware that that was present on this campus.
But 20-year-old Dominique Butler, who is majoring in theater arts, says a friend did confide in her that she'd been raped by a fellow student but didn't report it.
She was afraid of what her family would say. She was afraid no one would believe her.
The latest statistics from the Department of Education show one rape occurred at Morgan State in 2012. The school is under investigation after a student filed a complaint in March alleging she had been sexually assaulted by another student in off-campus housing. Morgan's president, Wilson, says the school can't divulge any information about the case, but says preventing sexual violence is a top priority.
When we have our orientation here, you know, we basically talk with students about sexual violence and let them know that they really need to have the other person to give their consent.
Wilson says administrators have and will continue to undergo Title IX training to understand the school's responsibility when it comes to preventing and responding to sexual violence. Amelia Cobb, the founder of the Right Group, which consults on issues of social change, was the force behind an initiative launched on HBCU campuses in 2008 to help schools focus on gender-based violence. Cobb says many financially strapped HBCUs focus on economic priorities, but have not taken the lead on creating transparent policies for dealing with sexual assaults.
They want the help, but when it comes to actually putting and addressing violence against women in general and implementing that into their existing system, whether that's an academic setting, an orientation, a training for an RA on a consistent basis, it just doesn't happen.
About 40 miles away from Morgan in Washington, D.C., there's another acclaimed HBCU, Howard University. Over the past 4 years, it's received about $600,000 in Justice Department grant money to devise programs to combat sexual violence. Last month, it held a mandatory Title IX orientation session for freshmen. Professor Tricia Bent-Goodley told the students there must be a straightforward affirmation when it comes to agreeing to have sex.
Really, our goal is primarily to make sure students have a sense of what does domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault, and stalking look like.
Bent-Goodley says students also need to know who they can turn to for help. 20-year-old Kristen McCovery, a senior now, says she was assaulted by a fellow student when she was a freshman and didn't know what to do.
It was January. A group of my friends, I think there was a house party and other people wanted to go to the club.
McCovery, who wanted to be identified, says she and her roommate waited for a couple of friends in an all-male dorm. She said they had all been drinking. When the young men arrived, her roommate left with her boyfriend. McCovery stayed with the remaining friend and they ended up having consensual sex. But when she wanted to leave, McCovery says it turned ugly.
And at first we had consensual sex and after that I was like, I'm really ready to go. And that wasn't the case for him. So when I was trying to leave and get dressed, he pushed me back on the bed and ended up hitting my head on his window ledge. And after that, I remember him turning around while still holding me to, like, turn the music up. And I was trying to bang on the walls and scream, but nobody could hear me because the music was so loud.
McCovery filed charges with D.C. Metro Police, but says she didn't get a call until months later. And police told her missing information meant they would not pursue the case. She says she also reached out to her resident advisor, another student, but nothing came of that either. Her alleged assailant still attends the school.
And for me, it's stressful seeing him, you know, going to class or if I have a class with him.
In a statement released after NPR brought the case to the school's attention, Howard President Wayne A.I. Frederick says he's committed to fostering a campus environment where assault is prevented and victims are fully supported, and the school's Title IX coordinator is now investigating. The largest survey about sexual assaults on HBCU campuses was conducted in 2008 by the nonprofit research group RTI International. Lead researcher Christopher Krebs says 4,000 undergraduate women at four HBCUs participated. He says the rates of sexual assault where women were incapacitated in some way, for example, drunk and unable to provide consent, was considerably lower than on other college campuses, 6.2% versus 11% at non-HBCUs.
Alcohol use at HBCUs was considerably lower than alcohol use at non-HBCUs.
Krebs says black women attending predominantly white institutions also had lower rates of drinking alcohol and lower rates of incapacitated sexual assault.
So it's not so much maybe a campus phenomenon as it is a race phenomenon where black undergraduate women are simply drinking at considerably lower rates.
Emory University professor Angela Amar, who's also studied sexual assault issues, points to the high female-to-male ratio on HBCU campuses and says a cultural variable may also be impacting the lower numbers of reported rapes.
It's like you don't want to turn in your brother who's doing well on campus, that, you know, there's so few of them. And so maybe it's really not so bad.
In an effort to raise awareness, Morgan State is developing brochures about Title IX and how to prevent rapes. Next spring, Howard University will hold a bystander prevention program to continue what faculty call needed tough conversations for HBCUs. Cheryl Corley, NPR News.
It's taken almost 2 years, but Atlanta prosecutors say they've gathered enough evidence to go after 12 educators accused of manipulating student test scores. Originally, 35 were indicted, but more than half took plea deals. Rose Scott from member station WABE in Atlanta reports that a trial is finally getting underway on what was described as the biggest cheating scandal in American education.
It's been 3 years since Georgia's Governor Nathan Deal announced the findings of a state-ordered investigation into cheating within the Atlanta public school system.
We found cheating in 44 of the 56 schools we examined. There were 38 principals of those 56 schools found to be responsible for or directly involved in cheating.
Based on those findings, it took nearly 2 years for Atlanta prosecutors to gather enough evidence to indict 35 school employees, and that included former Superintendent Dr. Beverly Hall. Standing before a horde of reporters and flashing cameras in March of 2013, Atlanta's District Attorney Paul Howard addressed the media.
What we are asking is that the attorneys and the defendants, that they would turn themselves in at the Fulton County Jail on Tuesday. And I believe Tuesday is April the 2nd.
At that same press conference, an Atlanta parent, Justina Collins, said the indictment was necessary because educators betrayed students, and that included her daughter.
I have a 15-year-old now who is behind in achieving her goal of becoming what she wants to be when she graduates. It's been hard trying to help her catch up.
Back then, Collins' daughter, Jawana Guffey, was a student at Cascade Elementary School located in Southwest Atlanta.
This happened when I was in fifth grade, and now I'm in the eighth, doing good, but I still got to live with this for the rest of my life, and I still got to remember that I was in a cheating scandal at my old school.
Atlanta prosecutors must prove that students' answers on standardized tests were changed after the fact, by erasing wrong answers to correct ones. The motives, prosecutors say, included financial reward as the incentive and a culture of intimidation. Teachers and some principals feared losing their jobs. As Atlanta's cheating scandal made headlines across the nation, it rekindled the debate over standardized testing. Leah Ward Sears is Georgia's former Chief Justice of the state's Supreme Court.
You know, it calls into question not only the viability of the 2001 No Child Left Behind Act, but also the ethics of our educators, you know, and how far are you willing to go to sacrifice quality education?
Under the No Child Left Behind Act, students needed to pass standardized tests to move on to the next grade. Prosecutors say pressure to achieve high test scores from then-Superintendent Dr. Beverly Hall and other district executives came down to principals, teachers, and even testing coordinators. All of the defendants are being tried at once, and all are facing racketeering charges under RICO laws. Meanwhile, only months into her term as the new school chief, Dr. Maria Karstoffen says she recognizes it will take time to regain the community's confidence.
Right now, we have more than enough information, both from the research that was provided by the district attorney to the district. You know, if everybody can get on the right path, we'll be able to push through this and really plan for a more successful future.
Legal experts expect that it could take 3 to 6 months for a verdict. For NPR News, I'm Rose Scott in Atlanta.